Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So, I had in mind that we would be talking about some new breakthroughs, and also some musings about information theory and the practical implications of the science of trying to figure things out. But I got into an interesting conversation just before this program, and I wanted to share it with you and also kind of do a sort of, let's call it a book review type summary of vaccination. We're talking about a few different vaccinations to start us off. So let's start with the newest and most recent vaccine. So I'm going to globally talk about COVID vaccine, but I'm really emphasizing the mRNA vaccines because they're a novel new technology and because they have worked so very, very well. In 18 months, we've gone from the 1918 flu-like level of pathogenicity in the virus to, at least in this country, the common cold-like level of pathogenicities. That's pretty darn good when you consider that there wasn't a vaccine when this started. Recent advances in technology, which we've already talked about on this program, have made it possible to basically make a plug-and-play sort of a vaccine. We just plonk something in. Of course, we have to validate it, but we've validated the vehicle now. And these vaccines are fundamentally different in the way they're made and also in the way that they can be upscaled, scaled up, and also changed in response to, as we're looking at it, variations in the actual virus that we're fighting. And we certainly are fighting a terrible virus. We'll come back to that, you know, how it's hard not to talk about that at least a little bit on the show. But I wanted to just kind of run down in my 30 years of practicing medicine a little bit about the childhood vaccinations, because that's what the conversation was about. As you probably know, California has created a fairly strong law that says in order to go to school, you need to be vaccinated. And the legitimate concerns here are infecting others, infecting vulnerable household members like newborns or other individuals who could conceivably die when the child vectors home a disease they pick up at school. Now, let us not forget that grade school children are culture media, and there are over 30 common colds that kids have to get before they develop much in the way of resistance. As any parent knows, as soon as your child goes into a congregate setting, whether that's daycare or kindergarten, you're going to have the opportunity to boost your immunity to colds because you're going to get exposed to the latest version of all of the other coronaviruses and the rhinoviruses and the adenoviruses, the usual suspects when you're talking about a respiratory infection. And we don't have vaccines for any of these things right now. We could. We could now make an mRNA vaccine for a version of the common cold. I don't know if you'll be able to plug 30 different forms of messenger RNA in there, but we're going to talk more about maybe a way to do that, or at least to create a universal vaccine. There's talk of doing that for flu by using the conserved areas. So this new technology is going to be a game changer in many ways, not just for vaccines, but also for drug delivery, particularly, I think, cancer care. But I digress. So I'm just going to give you my 4 stars, 2 stars, 3 stars review. None of them get 1 star. And my reasons for that. So let's start out with the mRNA vaccines. Definitely 4-star vaccines as far as their efficacy and what they've been able to do for our society. Too bad not everyone wants to get them, but, you know, land of the free, home of the brave. And I respect everyone's opinion. I disagree that there's nothing in it for you, at least if you have any regard for your fellow man, even if you are healthy and are unlikely to suffer bad consequences. Well, we know that this virus is evil and that people transmit it without even being sick. We'll talk more about that later. Let's talk about DPT. That's diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus. I'm going to start with tetanus. Okay, tetanus is a soil organism. It's a form of Clostridia, similar to the bug that causes botulism. It's the toxin that makes you sick. So the vaccine is directed at making sure you have plenty of antibodies that will deactivate the toxin. You don't really care about having the bacteria. You care about the bacteria getting into a nice area where there is no oxygen and producing a lot of toxin because it's so happy there. Then there's diphtheria, a very, very old disease that one pretty much never sees anymore because of vaccination. It used to kill a lot of babies. In 30 years, I've never seen a case. Pertussis, on the other hand, that's whooping cough. Well, pertussis is a problem. Let's go back fast. Let's reverse, rewind the Wayback Machine, go back 15 years. At that point, the pertussis vaccine used live attenuated virus. The live virus pertussis component of the vaccine could cause a drastic immune response, and that immune response could cause encephalitis, seizures, and even death. Very rare, 1 in 50,000 infants, but that's obviously 1 in 50,000 infants too many. That's where the vaccine adverse event fund comes from. It comes from the pertussis vaccine. Well, back there about 15 years ago, Japan decided that 1 in 50,000 was too many, so they stopped using the pertussis vaccine, possibly stopped mandating it. I really am not sure which. And they lost 5,000 kids the next year to pertussis because whooping cough really will kill a baby in record time. Their airways are small, they swell up, they suffocate. They basically cough themselves to death. So we don't see that anymore. Pertussis is an annoying disease if you get it as an adult, but lethal if you get it as a child. But a new vaccine came along, this one using a killed version of the pertussis antigen. So it seemed like, well, this will not be as antigenic. We won't get that huge response. We won't get the 1 in 50,000 encephalitis. True enough. The problem is we also don't get very good persistent immunity. The immunity lasts about 2 years. So now we're thinking about how often do we have to revaccinate kids? How often do we have to revaccinate adults? Because it does actually wear off. And you can't give a childhood pertussis vaccine. You have to use an adult vaccine in adults because otherwise they'll get a massive overreaction of their immune system. So basically, if you're a grandparent or an expecting grandparent, you can expect to get a pertussis vaccine because all the pediatricians are saying nobody gets through the doors until the kid's been vaccinated unless they themselves have been vaccinated. That's called cocooning. It's a good idea. But as you can imagine, it's also an idea that needs to be thought about. Could we come up with a better vaccine? I sure hope so, because we really need one. So using COVID vaccine as my 4-star, I have to give the DPT 3 stars, effective but not durable, so it loses it on the long term. Let's talk MMR. Very durable. 2 vaccinations gives you lifelong immunity, no boosters required. We'll go by the diseases. Let's start with mumps. Mumps is a nasty disease. It affects the salivary glands and the lymph nodes, causes a lot of swelling, but it unfortunately also infects the testicles and causes permanent sterility in men. Permanent sterility, that's a bad thing. Rubella is called German measles, very minor illness unless you happen to be pregnant. A pregnant woman who gets rubella is highly likely to have a child with severe birth defects, including blindness and heart abnormalities. Pretty nasty disease. And of course, if we don't vaccinate the children and the mother hasn't been isn't vaccinated, we're looking at the possibility of a very, very bad outcome for that pregnancy. What about measles? Well, measles is pretty benign in children. Adults who get measles, and I've seen cases of this because we used to only give 1 measles vaccination, and it turned out it wore off. So people who missed the boat, didn't get natural measles because they were born after that had evaporated, got the measles vaccine as an adult. Well, 10 years later, they were vulnerable again, and we didn't know that. Turns out the second booster does the trick. So far, so good on that. And we're at 20 years out now. So probably not going to see too much measles encephalitis, although who knows? Maybe we need to revaccinate people at 30 years. Certainly, if we continue to have a cohort of the population that chooses not to vaccinate and is allowed, if someone wants to be on their own, then they're on their own. But I'm not sure that they should be allowed in public school. So I give MMR actually a pretty high mark here, folks. I'm going to give it a 4+. I think it's a good vaccine. I think the concerns about it have been greatly exaggerated. If you want to send me an email to argue with me, I'll read it and we can have a discussion. Let's go on to polio. Definitely a 4-star vaccine. We won't get into the two polios, the oral and the injectable, but the injectable polio vaccine is killed virus, never gave anybody polio. And I personally know, as friends, two people who've had polio, one of whom lives in Indonesia and is an artist, and she's a wonderful person, but let's just put it this way. There's no Americans with Disability Act in Indonesia. If you're wheelchair bound, you're pretty constrained in your mobility in a culture with no sidewalks. And also Dale. Yes, Dale Owen, a friend, a long old friend from the radio, a courageous man, a wonderful man. Those of you who were longtime listeners of KUSP will remember Dale. Dale was also a patient of mine and had these horrendous braces that he had to use because he'd lost most of the control and musculature of his lower extremities. But Dale was determined to be a walker, kind of like that scene in Forrest Gump, except Forrest didn't need those braces and Dale needed them to remain upright. So polio, definitely a 4-star vaccine. Let's talk Hib. That's the Haemophilus influenzae vaccine. That also gets 4 stars for me. It's a good vaccine, lifelong immunity, and most importantly, when I was in training, and in the first maybe 5 years, there was a pediatric ward at every hospital that always had kids in it, kids being treated for meningitis. Well, you rarely see a child in the hospital anymore because you rarely see a child gets meningitis. It doesn't happen very often now that we have the Hib vaccine. It also cut back on ear infections drastically, which allowed us to cut back on antibiotic use, which means a whole new generation of kids whose microbiomes aren't trashed. Pretty good thing. 4 stars. So now let's go to hepatitis B. Well, Hep B. Let's talk what the disease is, all right? The disease is highly, highly contagious. Before we had Hep B vaccine, this disease, first of all, will eat your liver about 5% of the time. Treatment is supportive, and the rates of death for it are substantial. In 1 out of 200, 1 out of 300 severe cases require hospitalization. So pretty darn bad. And the disease often does not heal. So people develop a chronic case, making them chronically contagious. The good news about Hep B, blood and body fluids. So at least gloves, condoms, shields help the medical personnel. However, a tiny little speck of hepatitis B blood in your eyeball will potentially give you the disease. So medical workers were really glad when this vaccine came along. And it's reduced the need for liver transplantation and helped a lot of people, including many people with IV drug use or people who require transfusions. This was great. But it doesn't get 5 stars. And part of the reason is because of the social policy around this. I don't believe in blanket policies. I think medical care should be nuanced. And Hep B was the first case where things got a little bit heavy-handed. And we decided to vaccinate newborns. Now, the social argument in favor of vaccinating newborns was that the mothers might be infected with hepatitis B, that the mothers might have lifestyles that would cause them to be infected and therefore infect the newborns. So we're going to vaccinate the newborns. You know, maybe we should vaccinate all pregnant women, but then we'd have to round up the ones that are off the grid, homeless or living in living off the grid for whatever reason, including drug abuse. So the social decision was, let's vaccinate the newborns, we'll protect the kids that way. But it was one more vaccine. And certainly in the practice that I've had in my life, I think we could have probably bifurcated that decision and not gone with a one-size-fits-all. But that's me and my bias about thinking through the possibilities. Then varicella, chickenpox. Well, this one gets harder because chickenpox is a benign, usually self-limited disease of childhood. The best argument for giving the chickenpox vaccine is that eventually we're going to eliminate shingles. Now we have a shingles vaccine, so do we really need to vaccinate everybody for chickenpox? It's, I guess, a good thing, but I'm going to give this vaccine in terms of benefit, let's call it social benefit, and let's just say the flack that it generates to have too many vaccines that we're pushing on people. I'd say this one could be given a miss, but it's not going to be in the state of California. So, varicella gets 3 stars, as does hepatitis B, because I think the social policies around them are not justified by the merits. My preference for vaccination is spread them out. And I will say almost as in the 99.999% level of almost, kids will easily handle the adjuvants, the irritation, the pain from the shot, and the et cetera, whatever you've read, whatever you're worried about. There's so much crap in our environment already. You know whether the kid's a canary. You know this is a vigorous 2-month-old. They can handle a little adjuvant. They can handle a little aluminum salt. Their immune system is going to need help learning to identify this illness, which could kill them. This is no big deal. We're talking tiny tempest in a microscopic teapot here. This is not a big deal. Every 2 weeks, you give a different vaccine. The immune system has a chance to go after it. They go after it. Now we're in this polarized world where what I've just said represents an anti-vaxxer stance. I'm sorry. I am a pro-vaxxer. I am in favor of vaccines. I think vaccines are awesome. So I'm going to jump to some of the emails that we got over the last week. Start with one here from Sally, and Sally did not tell us where she was from. Dear Dr. Don, I love your podcast and have learned so much listening to it. I'm 58 years old, a few years into menopause, and I'm interested in starting bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. I recently consulted with a functional medicine doctor who wants to prescribe oral hormones via a compounding pharmacy. I had read about the issues with taking estrogens and testosterone orally, including negative impacts on the liver, and mentioned this to the doctor. She said that these tablets use, quote, bioavailable lymphatic absorption, bypassing the liver. I tried searching this phrase, but was not able to find anything I could understand, only articles too technical for me. So I thought I would reach out to you to see if you had heard of this technology and if this form of hormones are safe to take. Thanks so much for all you do. Thank you, Sally, for a really interesting question. It sent me off to Google Scholar, where I came upon one article from 2014 discussing recent advances in lymphatic-targeted drug delivery systems for tumor metastasis. And, of course, this is not your topic, but the lymphatic-targeted drug delivery, I think, does kind of fit in with what we're talking about. If the lymph system's going to absorb it, then it's going to pass. I'll cut to the chase and say that there are a number of problems with this, and chiefly my concern is, why use something that is undoubtedly more expensive and unproven with potentially issues rather than just use a topical? And we're going to come back to that question. Let's talk a little bit about the lymphatic system, because I thought this would be a great opportunity. It was about 1600-something when the lymphatic system was first described by Gasparo Acelli, one of those early dissection people back there with Leonardo da Vinci and others, who found milky veins in the mesentery of well-fed dogs. Hope the dogs weren't vivisected, but it's completely possible given what they were doing in those days. Now, the lymphatic system is a network that consists of lymphatic vessels, little tubes, the lymph nodes, the spleen, the thymus, and Peyer's patches, which are sort of flat lymph nodes lining the gut and just around the intestines, and tonsils. This system has a very important role in immune surveillance and response. This is the sensor, kind of like the smoke alarm, if you will, that is going to be one of the first places that your body is able to sense that a pathogen has gotten on. It's completely independent of the cardiovascular system. It's a totally different set of pipes. And it's almost a secondary vascular system because it does have a connection to the pipes. And that's because the lymphatic system ultimately, after circulating through all these areas I've talked about, dumps into the superior vena cava, the pipe that goes back to the right side of the heart. The lymph gets mixed with the blood and heads back out as blood fluid. You get out to the periphery. The capillaries, vascular capillaries, leak fluid, and much of this fluid is taken up by the lymph vessels and brought back on a circuitous route through the lymph nodes and the Peyer's patches and the spleen and the thymus and the tonsils, and then back into the general circulation. And while it meanders around this route, the white blood cells, the macrophages, the T lymphocytes are sitting, hanging out like firefighters at the fire station in the lymph nodes, paying attention to what's passing through. And if they see something that looks like a pathogen, they snap to attention, the alarm goes off, and the immune system begins to work. And the lymphatic system has a one-way open-ended transport. It doesn't have any central driving force. There's no pump there. The pump is your own movement, your own activity. The muscles essentially squeeze the lymph vessels. And the system starts in the dermis, the part of the skin that bleeds when you skin your knee. That's the dermis, where the blood vessels are. They're blind-end little pipes that are about the size of blood capillaries, and they're a single thin wall with big holes between them. You're all familiar with a soaker hose for a garden. Well, imagine a sponge hose whose job is not to dump water into the system, but to suck water out of the tissue. They're designed, or they have evolved, to lack tight junctions so that they can suck things up, not just fluid, but also larger particles. The gaps are about 120 nanometers in size. 120 is 12 times bigger than the gaps in a blood capillary. So you can get cells in there, and you can get large particles, including broken bits of bacteria. That is really going to wake up the immune system when it gets to a lymph node. The lymphatic system is important for recognizing things, but it's also important to realize that this is hijacked by cancer. So most solid cancers initially spread from the primary site of the cancer through the lymphatic tissue. Remember, I said cells can get in there and end up fetching up in the lymph nodes. That's why we stage cancer with, okay, is it local? Has it spread to surrounding tissue or spread to the lymph nodes? And generally, lymph nodes are the first place you look for a cancer. Now that we understand the lymph system, I mentioned those Peyer's patches. So I'm assuming, for Sally's question, that what's going to happen is that you're going to take a substance, and this substance is going to be a liposome or some other fat-soluble encasing of the hormone itself, and that this is going to be absorbed by the Peyer's patches and go directly through the lymphatic system. But here's the rub. The lymphatic system doesn't deliver the estrogen to the ovaries except through the bloodstream. So what will happen is it'll go through the lymphatics, it's assuming it's true, dump into the general circulation. It will bypass first past metabolism, which is to say 90% of what we eat or put in our mouth goes through the liver. If it avoids going through the liver, then the liver doesn't have to react to it or detoxify it. And the reason that we give oral estrogen at tenfold higher doses than we give topical estrogen, like in a patch, is because 90% of it is destroyed in the liver. In the process of destroying it, the liver actually builds some extra muscles. And those muscles, if you will, these are enzyme systems, not muscles. But these enzyme systems that are upregulated by the liver working on the estrogen actually cause more clotting proteins to be made. It's an unintended side effect of giving oral estrogen supplementation. Now, during pregnancy, you're very likely to have higher levels of clotting protein. That's why pregnant women get blood clots in their legs very easily. And the reason for that is you need to be able to clot if you start to lose that pregnancy or if you go into labor and the placenta tears. Being able to clot is important for surviving delivering a baby. So our biology preloads those clotting factors. And when we give large enough doses orally of bioidentical or chemical hormone replacement, we get the upregulation of the clotting factors. That doesn't happen with patches. It doesn't happen with topicals. And I do not think, and I want to emphasize, I do not think that would happen with this bioavailable lymphatic absorption. But my question is, why wouldn't it also go through the liver? Why wouldn't half of this stuff go through the liver? So I'm concerned that you won't get the benefit that you're looking for by using this. And I could not find anything in the peer-reviewed literature that suggested that anybody knows how to dose this or that anybody had actually proven that these were getting into the tissues, which would say the bone and the brain and the other tissues that you're worried about helping by giving this bioidentical estrogen treatment. I'm assuming that it's being given orally. I looked through the literature and didn't find a lot of evidence that things that got into the lymph system got out again. And so I'm going to say probably not a great idea until these claims are more established and proven. Another thing that you're giving up here is if you take it orally, I'm not quite sure what happens with food. When you eat food, if you eat fat, is that going to break down the liposomes? Is that going to increase the absorption? I don't know, and I couldn't find anything to tell me. I also worry that the food might grab onto the compound and reduce the dose, and so you didn't say whether they were going to tell you to take it on an empty stomach. I like topicals because they have a depot effect. Estrogen soaks into the tissue, and a certain amount of that does get into the lymphatics, but that's not what we worry about. And we know it gets into the tissue, and we also know if you skip a topical cream or the patch falls off, you don't fall off a cliff with your hormone levels. You drop, but you drop gradually because of that depot effect. So I would encourage you to look more into topical hormone replacement. I really feel that that is very established as safe and very good for the majority of postmenopausal women. All right, let's do another email from Andrew. Andrew in Soquel writes, reasonable. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I'm wondering what's reasonable for this situation. I'm vaccinated for COVID and take immune-suppressing drugs. One is methotrexate, which has been studied. I've not yet had an antibody test to see if the vaccine worked. A plumber is coming to the house. I told him I'm immunocompromised and asked if they would wear an N95. They replied that they don't have N95s. Parenthetically, Andrew, I think they've decided that they don't want to spend the money to buy them. They are available, in fact. I thought about giving the plumber an N95 or asking them to send a vaccinated plumber or run my bathroom and kitchen vent fans and wear an N95 while they're here or look for a company that will accommodate me or something else. Please help me decide how to proceed. Okay, so first of all, Andrew, it's great that it's summer because you can open the windows and you can be ventilating the space with fans. I think if you wear an N95 while interacting, the main thing is to make sure that it's a good fit. The easiest way to do that is to really make sure that nose thing is shaped to your nose and look in a mirror and breathe in, and the N95 should suck in when you breathe in vigorously. So if you breathe in and you see the mask collapse a little bit, that tells you that you're not pulling a bunch of air from the room. The whole point with vaccines is let's have the plumber wear at least a regular surgical mask. Doesn't have to be an N95. A regular surgical mask is going to keep most of what comes out of his mouth in the mask. And you could give him a fresh mask when he walks through the door. Have him put it on outside. If you want to give him an N95 and he's willing to wear it, that's great. And I like that option best. As far as having them send a vaccinated plumber, I'd still want that vaccinated plumber wearing a mask because, unfortunately, the latest data suggests that the vaccination is not enough. The vaccination isn't enough because the Delta doesn't keep people from shedding virus. Vaccination, people who've been vaccinated will shed virus and they won't have symptoms. They don't get sick. When I said that the vaccine turned it into the common cold, that's exactly what I mean. Probably half the people who get a cold don't get sick enough to even know they are shedding virus, but it's a cold. The thing is, this isn't a cold. And you really don't know if your vaccine has taken well enough. Antibody tests are not accurate enough to really validate, especially if you got your vaccine 6 months ago. The antibodies will have dropped substantially, but it's not antibodies right now that are protecting you. It's your T-cell immunity. And we have plenty of evidence that your T-cell immunity is doing just fine. Thank you very much. So I hope that I've helped. I think looking for a company that will accommodate you is, let's just say that it's a seller's market when it comes to getting a plumber in this town. So I think you should keep your bird in the hand and just do what you need to do to protect yourself. Going outside, or if you don't feel comfortable trusting the plumber and you want to be in the place, certainly social distancing, you wearing an N95, that's plenty if you're unvaccinated. And as long as you've got that room cleaned out and the air cleaned out, I'd hit the surfaces with the 10% bleach or something and put all my dishes inside close the compartments or wash the dishes that are in the rack afterwards. Very unlikely, but what the heck? We're doing belt and suspenders here because you are more vulnerable, despite having done everything you should have done, including getting vaccinated. Now I'm going to tell you about some really exciting medical breakthroughs. Let's start with neuroprosthesis restores words to man with paralysis. So researchers have successfully developed a speech neuroprosthesis that enabled a man with severe paralysis to communicate in sentences, translating signals from his brain to the vocal tract directly into words that appeared as text on a screen. How did they do that? How did they do that? They read his brain. What were they reading? Well, I'm going to tell you. This was at UCSF, and they have been working on this for years. This is the neurologic surgery and neurology departments, and it is really impressive. It's taken a decade for UCSF neurosurgeon Edward Chang to develop this technology, and this came out in last week's New England Journal of Medicine. It's, so far as anyone knows, the first successful demonstration of direct decoding of thoughts, of full words from the brain activity of someone who's paralyzed and cannot speak. This has enormous potential. Every year, thousands of people lose the ability to speak due to a stroke or an accident. And previously, our work in this field has focused on restoring communication through spelling-based approaches, having people move their eyeballs and have that picked up so that they type out letters one by one in text. There's a wonderful French movie called The Butterfly and the Bell Jar that will give you a very good idea of how incredibly tedious this is. Chang's team did something very different. They translated signals on the brain that were intended to control the muscles of the vocal system. See, it turns out that the muscles are key here because when you tell your brain to move your lips and move your mouth in just such a way to make speech, those signals are on the surface of your brain and can be picked up by sensors. We do the same thing with the work having a chimpanzee move a cursor with his brain. He's got electrodes implanted on the brain, and he can think about reaching for the banana, and the signal that he would use was the same signal as if he was imagining a phantom arm reaching out to grab that banana. Well, it turns out those phantoms exist as neurological signals on the surface of our brain. This works better because speech is a natural and fluid thing as opposed to spelling. We normally communicate with speech very fast, 150 to 200 words per minute. So without having to spell out the words, imagine if you had to spell every word, how long it would take you. Now, they got a boost from the UCSF Epilepsy Center that does a lot of neurosurgery on seizure patients who can't be managed with drugs. And they pinpoint the origin of the seizures using electrode arrays that are placed on the surface of their brains, kind of like a flexible keyboard, except it's a sensor. Now, these patients, the epileptics, volunteered to have their brain recordings analyzed for speech-related activity. So while the surgeons were trying to find the seizure, these people were talking, and the researchers were able to capture the cortical activity patterns associated with the vocal tract movements for each consonant and each vowel. And these are unique. So A, E, I, O, U, obviously different movements of the tongue and the lips, and everything, every consonant, every sound is there encoded in the motor movements of the tongue, lips, and palate. So once they had the patterns, they could start correlating them and creating a Rosetta Stone, if you will, for the brainwave to speech. Their first participant in the study, known as Bravo, Brain-Computer Interface Restoration of Arm and Voice, had a brainstem stroke more than 15 years ago. This is the same kind of stroke as the guy in that movie I mentioned had. And it severely damaged the connection between his brain and his vocal tract and his limbs. He used to communicate by wearing a baseball cap with a stick on it, poking letters on a screen. But he worked with the researchers to create a 50-word vocabulary. The vocabulary included words like water, family, and good, and it's enough to create hundreds of sentences. Think about, say, the average 3.5-year-old who probably has a 50-word vocabulary at that point, but they can sure communicate. For the study, they implanted a high-density electrode array over the speech motor cortex, and they recorded 22 hours of neural activity over 48 sessions, and in each session, Bravo 1, the subject, attempted to say each of the 50 vocabulary words many, many times while the electrodes recorded their signals. They then used artificial intelligence to translate the recorded activity into the words. Knowing what the words did allowed them to do this. Then they created a device that would recognize essentially the words and type them on a screen. They started talking to him and saying, "Would you like some water?" And he was able to say, "No, I'm not thirsty." The system was able to decode words from brain activity at about 18 words per minute, which is not that fast, but is way better than spelling. And this is just the beginning. This is a proof of principle. It's going to be a lot more work and a lot more computational analysis in order to get this going anywhere. But I want to take a moment and tell you about a patient of mine. As a matter of fact, I'll be going to his memorial service in a few days. But this patient of mine was an avid surfer. He came in with having trouble surfing, and his ankle was floppy on physical exam. I thought he might have damaged the tendon because he tended to be quite the aggressive surfer and had taken some rather spectacular tumbles in the waves and had some bruising. But in fact, what he had was a neurologic foot drop. What he had was ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And gradually over the next 2-3 years, he lost the ability to walk, the ability to move his arms, and eventually the ability to breathe. At that point, he had to be placed on a ventilator and have a tracheostomy, which eliminated his ability to speak. He also developed severe problems with secretion. Managing him in the home, which his heroic family did for over a decade, was an amazing feat of courage on the part of all individuals concerned. But it was very difficult. He developed, well, essentially, he lost all of the muscle mass in his body. As a result of not having any muscles, he developed insulin resistance and later diabetes. He still continued to survive. He communicated by a computer sensor that read his eyeball movement as he looked at a screen. And he wrote scientific papers. He wrote applications. He managed to get a drug company to let him be part of a study on an investigational new drug for ALS. I was involved with this intimately through the entire time. The drug was not successful, but it may in the future. Failures yield data, and data eventually gets us to the place where we may be able to do something. But as I read this article about this speech translator, I think about the next 10 years. I think about people who develop ALS in 2030. And I think about their being able to have a device, maybe even a device that doesn't penetrate the skull, that doesn't have to be implanted, that will allow them to speak with their family. Sure, it'll be the Stephen Hawking voice, but nevertheless, this type of ability, this type of technology is within our grasp for the first time in human history. And it's to be celebrated. It's to be appreciated. Our technology and our willingness to apply so much money, so much resources to trying to better the lives of others, that's what makes me love humanity, right? We certainly have our problems, but ultimately, we're pretty good, and we are the smartest monkeys that have ever existed, and we're making things happen. Let's keep making things happen in a positive way. We're going to make mistakes, but let's keep making things happen, and if I think the sum total of positive will outweigh the negative. Following right up on that story, Georgia Institute of Technology has been playing around with wearable machine brain interfaces that will allow a user's motor in imagery to control a wheelchair or a robotic arm or other devices. People with motor dysfunction or paralysis are obviously severely limited. If you could say that there's a benefit from the wars in Iraq and the Middle East, and those awful IEDs, you could say that it's all those amputations that have led to major advances in prosthetics. It's the silver lining in a very, very dark cloud, but it is the making of lemonade, right? These have not been comfortable. The major advantage of this new system is that it's soft and it doesn't have any wires, so it's, I guess, working by Bluetooth, and it is basically a hat that's worn. It has very, very small wires which penetrate the skull. So you don't need gels and you don't need pastes, and it stays in place when the person moves their head. This will allow a person to run a robot arm, maybe turn on the lights, be able to do so many things that otherwise they were paralyzed. And in the most recent study, volunteers who did not have any paralysis were able to control things in virtual reality just using their thoughts. So that's a proof of concept. If you can control what goes on in virtual reality, you can control what happens in real reality using robots and robotic devices. I see this as something that's making me so optimistic about the monkey's ability to make the world better, to make the world better for people who are diseased and disabled. Many of you may have seen the movie Ready Player One. This is Ready Player One without the suit. It's space exploration without having to go there. We have to deal with the speed of light delay, but I think it's surmountable. It's remote operations. Imagine when that building in Florida collapsed. Imagine if we'd had robot weasels that could go in there, that could be driven. Essentially, you put on the hat and you're running the weasel, and it's got infrared vision, and you can go down there and you can find the living, warm bodies and direct the rescuers to the right location. And if the building collapses on the robot weasel, oh bad, but no one's hurt. Think about the potential for firefighting. You know, we're sending people into harm's way in massive numbers right now here in the Pacific Northwest. Imagine that we could do that with remote sensing things that we could actually drive. The potential is amazing. And this is just one small piece of a brave new world that I'm expecting to see materialize before my very eyes in the next decade. So more cool science, okay? During COVID, and you'll remember if you're a regular listener, hundreds of thousands of previously analyzed compounds were screened to see if they could attach to the COVID-19 spike protein or some other part of the virus to block entry or slow replication. This is a very big trial and error process. It's like having a big key ring, and you know that the house key is on it, but what you don't know is where that house key is. So you stand there at the door, and you put one key in, and you jiggle it, and then you put another key in, and you jiggle it, and you put another key in, and you jiggle it. But wouldn't it be great if you could predict which key it is, because the keys are all different color, and they tell you pick the red one? Well, we're talking about computers doing almost exactly that. This new program is called ROSE TTA Fold. It provides access to highly accurate protein structure prediction. Scientists around the world will be using it to build models that will accelerate research enormously. This began in 2020 at a conference called CASP-14, where the IBM supercomputer, the one that played chess, well, this IBM supercomputer can do more than that. It was able to come up with an algorithm that would predict protein folding and protein structures. This has been replicated by research at the Institute of Protein Design, and now it's been published online by the journal Science about a week ago. Over 140 independent research teams have downloaded it. This is going to speed up the process of predicting protein structures. It's going to allow us to build structures that will fit in to the lock and key. Rather than going and looking at what we've already studied, that key ring, we'll be able to design the key that fits in to the lock right there using AI, using this rapid kind of deep learning. And once you have the algorithm, you're done. You can do it over and over again and give away the software. So let's go back to how proteins form, okay? A protein comes from a little structure like a clamshell called a ribosome. It gets squeezed out one amino acid at a time, but these amino acids carry a charge, either a positive or a negative charge. Think like magnets, okay? And also some of the amino acids are neutral. They don't have a charge. So if you were making a string of beads and some of the beads were magnetic, as you put the beads on the string, when two magnets came in proximity to each other, they'd stick together, and that would create a kink in the stream, right? So now that kink is being held together by molecular forces. So you're building a shape that's going to emerge reproducibly into a certain pattern. So each magnet twists this shape, and the shape will hold together. As more amino acids emerge, the shape takes place that's dictated by the charge of the amino acids and these forces. Now, this will last as long as you don't put more energy into the system. If I heat the protein, let's say I boil it, the energy will cause the string to vibrate. The connections will be ripped apart and new ones will form. Think about when you cook a raw egg. It goes from being fluid to solid. And that's because new connections form and the string cross-links. And so now it's woven together, or more accurately, felted together like a piece of felt. And that's how protein structure works. If we're making something small, like an enzyme, we have to make sure that it's stable. And when you think about diseases, prion diseases, like, for example, mad cow disease, what you're talking about is a protein that got folded wrong. And not only is it folded wrong, so it isn't going to work well, but it's a contagious fold structure. So when it comes across another protein with the same sequence of amino acids, it can literally pull that protein out of shape and make another copy of itself. we are going to be able to make such progress using these new technologies. And I have one more story that winds about round back to coronavirus, which is that drugs often bind inside these pockets on proteins. That's how they work. They interfere with the protein's function. We can identify the drug binding pockets. And over time, the virus, let's say we're talking about a virus, the virus can mutate, but these sequences can't all mutate because they are needed for the virus to reproduce itself. This is called conservation. Researchers recently looked at 27 different coronavirus species, and they compared their drug binding pockets. And what they found were two conceivable sites for a coronavirus drug that would globally work because the virus could not mutate away from the drug because the site itself is critical for viral replication. And there's been plenty of opportunity over the history of coronavirus for this to mutate if it could. If it can't mutate because the mutation prevents the virus from having any activity, then we can go ahead and build a drug using this other technology and save the day. I can hear the hoofbeats. I hope it's the cavalry coming. But like I said, the show has been all about, you know, rah-rah technology, four stars. And ain't it great that we have this available to us? Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.